my place in tech changes every day. But I don't fear the future, because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts, so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
In the middle of 80s, I would say, with countries started falling apart economically. There was emptiness in the stores. It's hard for you guys to believe, but even in Moscow, in the capital city, I would go to the store and it would be maybe one kind of milk. You go to the bakery, it would be maybe two, three kinds of the bread. If you are lucky, extremely lucky, you might get a piece of cheese, but the lines were for hours. So feel me when I bring it, sing it loud. I'm from
the loop and I'm proud. Run a mile for the cause, I'm right. Hi guys, it's your girl Nechama, your favorite Jew from the Lou. Welcome back to my podcast. Today, we're really fortunate to have Yelena Fish over here, and she's a good friend of my mom's, and her story is so incredibly intriguing. So we're going to get right into it. I do love history, but there are certain parts of history that I know more about and certain parts that I'm curious and want to learn more about. So you grew up back in Russia when there was like the Iron Curtain. And so I would love to learn more about that because I did some brief research on my own, but no one could speak better than someone who actually experienced it. So to begin, why don't we talk about what it was like as a little girl growing up there?
Nechama, first of all, I want to a little bit change the name of the country where I grew up. I did not grow up in Russia. I grew up in the Soviet Union. And for your generation and probably a majority of younger people who are younger than 40 or 50, it's like an Ottoman Empire, something which is completely out of a map of the world. And many young people don't even know that this huge blob on the map that nowadays is called Russia was called for 70 plus years the Soviet Union. What was the Soviet Union? It was a combination, it was a galaxy of republics. Officially, it was called independent republics, but the huge territory was indeed Russia, and that's with the capital of Moscow, where I was born. And the rest were republics like Moldova, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and so forth. So this humongous territory, which was 1/6 of the whole world, was called the Soviet Union. So as you completely correctly said, in 1980, I might be a little bit off the numbers, but right before the 90s, the Soviet Union fell apart after the Berlin Wall, thanks to President Reagan a lot, and at the time, relatively progressive Russian leader Mikhail Gorbachev. Maybe you've heard the words perestroika, again, not your generation, but the generation of older, a little older people. It was a complete change and hope. All this gigantic territory and the people who lived there, that the country is taking a new and never experienced course, the course of that all the republics that in the constitution were called independent, they will be independent indeed and become a separate states. And Russia, humongous Russia, will be called Russia. Moscow was still the capital city And that's where I was born. As a young girl, you asked me the question, how was it? I would say we didn't know what country we lived in because the country was completely, it's hard for you guys to even imagine, but we lived in absolute exclusion, isolated from the entire world. So even if you would have some money, which most of the people were making very little money, but you could pay your apartment. Everything belonged to the government. Your apartment, almost nobody had a, very few people had a personal car, very few. None of our friends, even though both of my parents were civil engineers, here is a very respectful job. In Soviet Union, it was laughable job because engineers made such a tiny money that my mom, I remember, she would never cry about that, but she would kind of sarcastically laughing. She would get her, she would receive her payment once a month, and she immediately would give what she borrowed from other people and start borrowing again from the friends. So putting that aside, again, it was a lifestyle that we didn't know any better. And because the television was presenting that life is wonderful in the Soviet Union. Poor Americans, poor Western society lives in very scary, destructive world. There are so many jobless people who live on the streets. Believe it or not, there was a stories that black people are kicked and beaten with sticks left and right on the streets in America. So very bleak image of Western world, America in particular. So we lived in the best country of the world. So that's how the propaganda worked. 24 hours, you would turn on the television. There were only two or three programs, as far as I remember. And it was very always optimistic. We have the best education in our country. We have the best healthcare. Everything the best than in the Western world. So till the certain age, I lived like anybody else without any idea what is behind our curtains. Very few people were able to go abroad, even in the countries that were socialist countries like Poland, Bulgaria. It was a socialist bloc of countries that were created after the Second World War. So even to go to the nearby Bulgaria, it was almost impossible because you would have to go through incredible checkup, and you would have to be called to officials to stay to make a statement that you are real patriotic and you love your country and your country is the best. Even you would like to just go and have a vacation. So it was a very, very different world that it for you guys, it's very hard to imagine.
Yeah.
But at that time, till again, a certain age, I was probably a happy child as anybody else because we didn't know how bad we have, what the country we are living in.
So then at what point was it when the Iron Curtain came down, when you started to learn more information about how the rest of the world was? Was that the point where you started to see that there is hope and there is a better life? Were you out there?
Of course, what was always circulating among, I would say, intelligentsia, it's a word for people who are educated, who went through colleges and universities. It was always a black market of a literature. It could be just a magazines or written down stories, what happened in the West, in the reality, or it would be like a writings of those Russians who were expelled, like, you know, of course, Solzhenitsyn, or several very prominent Russian thinkers and poets and writers were able somehow to escape the Soviet Union. On behalf, they were risking their lives. And some literature was secretly and with a huge danger for those people who would bring it to the country, and not only bring it, but even hold it in your house. It was extremely dangerous to keep it in your house and try to give it to your close friend to read what really happens outside of or Iron Curtain. So I was lucky enough that at the age of probably, first of all, of course, I was listening just little bit. My parents talk with their close friends, and you have to understand that if you discuss politics or just the simple stories of people's life, it could be only if you completely trust to the person who you are talking to. You always talk in a small kitchen or in some small room because you don't know very many people who were having their own set of mind in their homes. They were secretly inserted, they were called bugs. So it's a electronic little,
like a recorder?
Recorders, right. So only with your very close friends you could discuss and even get some literature to read and start thinking on your own what's going on and what really what a society we live in. So and that's what happened. Many people, not many, but some very few people, would even go into the woods to either study this literature in small groups, not to knowing that somebody is not following them. And of course, I would say the majority of those people were Jews, believe it or not, even though it was a tiny little, just like anywhere else, it was a tiny little percentage of Jews living in the Soviet Union. Because first of all, you know it better than anybody else, how many Jews were killed during the Holocaust, Second World War. And after Holocaust, it was a mini Holocaust that Stalin, after the war, started in the Soviet Union. Those people who survived through this horror of the war and lost the majority of their relatives, they were, after all, followed by the Stalin regime. And if Stalin would not die in 1953, I believe the very tiny group of Jews who were still living in the Soviet Union and survived, they would be wiped up. And it is a huge amount of literature now that talks about that. We learned all about that during Perestroika and Glasnost. That's when, in the middle of 80s, I would say, with country started falling apart economically. There was emptiness in the stores. It's hard for you guys to believe, but even in Moscow, in the capital city, I would go to the store and it would be maybe one kind of milk. You go to the bakery, it would be maybe two, three kinds of the bread. If you are lucky, extremely lucky, you might get a piece of cheese, but the lines were for hours in the stores. Not even talking fresh fruits and vegetables. And there were markets where people were selling like a, people who grew up, like if you would live behind outside of the city, some people would grow a little garden and they would bring some fresh fruits or vegetables and sell them in the open market, like little markets here. But for most people, it was so expensive to buy, so they would literally buy one or two or three apples for their children, and parents would just be happy that so their kids would have some vitamins to eat.
Yeah, this is crazy to hear about, because you read stories, but it's one thing to like read a story and then actually talk to someone who's lived through the experience.
And interestingly enough, Moscow, for all the people who lived in different cities and different villages, they believed this. Moscovites, people who live in, again, capital or big cities, they are so lucky, they have so much. And they would come, there would be special trains full of people just to come to Moscow to buy like piece of clothes or shoes. And again, that they would stay in lines for hours and maybe even overnight to get a pair of shoes from, let's say, Czechoslovakia, which was also a country of the socialist bloc, but the quality and, you know, it was much better than the ugly shoes that were even not always available in the Russian stores. However, there were black markets, of course. People always would find ways. And there were people who you would come again into the house, or they would secretly meet you somewhere and they would offer you something that is either made in the country, but there's a labels, like if they are coming from Western world. But again, it was untouchable in price, so very few people could buy them. So again, as I said, the majority of intelligentsia, which were as hard as it was for the Jews to go to the university, it was huge quota. It would be, I don't know, one out of 200 people, 300 people. I can't tell you exact numbers, but when you come for the examination to be accepted to college or university, as soon as they see the Jewish last name, and the Jewish last name is always sounds differently because Russian last names are like here, like Smith, it means something. The Jewish last name, like mine, Fish, means fish here in the in America, but in Soviet Union, it immediately rings the bell. Haha, that's not Russian. And plus, everywhere you go to be hired for a job or to apply for the college university, you have to bring all your documents, your passport. And in your passport, the first question, your name, second, your last name, the date you were born, fourth, where your address, and we were called an ugly fifth question, your nationality. And your nationality, it's not Russian or Ukrainians, if you are Jewish just by blood, if you have to put Jewish, and that
would
was a know? Big red mark.
Would they know if you didn't? Like, could you just change your name or just forge it?
That was my story. That was exactly my story when I wanted to study editing and journalism in the university. I was told, even though I grew up in a vegetarian times, so the anti-Semitism was not as horrifying like it was in the time of my parents when they grew up. We were able to live in Moscow while the previous generations that I don't know if you ever read in the historical books, but it was so-called Pale of Settlement. So all the Jews, which again was a tiny little percentage, even before Jews started coming to America or Palestine at the beginning of the 19th and 20th centuries. End of 19th, beginning 20th centuries. So Jews were not allowed to live in any big cities, only in a small, tiny villages in Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania. That's why so many Jews who live here in America, they have all their relatives coming, as a rule, from these little places. Mm-hmm. Because Jews were not allowed, if you are a Jewish person, you could never be able to move west to any cities like St. Petersburg, Moscow, you name it. So anyway, why I started telling you that, oh, my own story. So at that time, there was some Jews still, after the revolution, that pronounced that all nations are equal. At the beginning of the Russian Revolution happened in 1917. So it was officially written on the paper that all the nations are equal, have the equal rights. That's why so many Jews became a part of socialist, communist movement, because they truly believed that now they can change their lifestyle. They were eager to get the education, move to big cities, study like anybody else, be citizens like anybody else, and not to be, for generation live the lifestyle that their great-great-grandparents had, and mainly the education that was pushing them out of the pale of settlement. And they naively, they believed that they will be allowed to get the same education, get the same jobs, be involved in regular job, in the regular life of the other people, like Russians, Ukrainians, Azerbaijanians. And for a little while, it was like that, but it changed quite quickly. So by the time my parents grew up, and even my time, which I said was much less cruel than towards the generation of my parents and my grandparents, when I came to apply to the university, I was given quite quite honest suggestion. Lena, with your last name and with your nationality, there is no way you will be accepted unless you change your last name. If you change your last name, if you change your documents, then maybe you will be accepted, but there is no guarantee. So it was not easy, of course, emotionally, and it was extremely hard, especially on my father's side. I had to do that to get my education. I still was not accepted. We had a day classes, like here you go in the morning, and for less fortunate people who either had a family or had to work, they were night classes. So my only way was to go through the night education, even after my last name was changed.
And so at this point, you were Jewish, but was there any religious connection at all? Or because you were living in the time where it was just so communist that it was all about just being Russian and blending in?
I had never knew what being Jewish even mean, believe it or not, till, again, I became teenager and not 13 or 14, but closer to 16. Beside, like, listening quite ugly and nasty jokes, which were so many, every second joke in Russia was about greedy and, you know, okay, let's put a point, greedy and ugly Jews. We were kikes. The common name for Jewish person. Even the people who would be like Russians, like my dad used to tell me many times, they would say, "Oh, Yuri, you are a great guy, even though you are a Jew." It was always said straight face to the person. So at the time when I was 16 years old, I started interested in, I think we all, when we are in our teenager, some people younger, some people older, but we start looking for some spiritual insight of our, in Jewish, yeah, now I, of course, know this neshama word. So who am I and what it really means to be Jewish? In Moscow, which again was absolutely, even in the good times, there were only 7 synagogues in Moscow where it was the tiniest percentage of Jews. Before revolution, I've heard that there were 7 synagogues. When I grew up, it was 1, and nobody other than very, very old people who had nothing to lose or risk, like in their 60s or 70s, only that old people would go to the synagogue to pray, because if you even enter the synagogue in Moscow, of course, you would be called on the carpet. I think this is the idiom in English. So you would be called on the carpet next day at your work or at your, you know, class if you are a student, and most probably you would lose your job, you're kicked out of the school. So, but at a certain time, again, towards the middle of 70s, some literature, the time started changing very slowly in the Soviet Union, because first and most importantly, economics. The country could not feed their people with all these gigantic resources, this huge territory, with so many, you know, with so many
resources,
even in the soil. You know, right now Russia sells oil and gas, but there is all the metals that are, everything, and even the land itself, it's a huge value. But the people were starving because of this communist socialist economics that country by country, when people in this country are so excited about the socialism, I always smile and laugh and say, guys, there is luckily no Soviet Union anymore or Soviet bloc, but go and try to live in Venezuela and feel what does it mean to live in socialism. Socialism never gives people decent lifestyle, decent income, decent medical care. It is, and it's always closed society because those who are in charge, they don't want the population know how the people live in this country. It is very clever, in a sense, politics. So they completely cut off the population of this country from entire world. So they have no, they could not make any comparison the way they live versus the rest of the world.
I mean, that explains why so many people from all over the world are trying to get to the United States, just because the opportunities that we have, the religious freedoms that we have, anyone can start from nothing and become something, which is incredible. So you had told me that you had come over with your ex-husband, your daughter, and you were pregnant at the time, and you knew nobody. So what was that like?
That's the hardest part of my whole life. I lived with my parents, again, in Soviet Union. There is not such thing like having, in my time, most of the families, it was nuclear family, mom, dad, children means one child or two children maximum, because people just could not afford more kids. And I have recently read that a Russian woman, Russian women on an average had about 11, 15 abortion per life, because wow. It was now no, you know, it was, they could not take care of many children. There was a lack of contraceptives and so forth. So one child was a lot, two kids were many. So that's why I had only my brother, who, to my sadness, he still lives in Russia. And if you want to tell, I'll tell you this story. But it's, we had nobody here in America. 90% of people from the Soviet Union who came in the 70s, it was a tiny little opening of the window of immigration during, it was Brezhnev time, the major politic person in the Soviet Union, because it was a huge push again in the West, let our people go. So, but in the 90s, it was the major exodus of Soviet Jews from the Soviet Union. And again, I'm bad with numbers, but 2/3 of Jews, if not more, left. And with this such a hardship of getting education by the Jewish person, the vast majority of Jews who came over to the West, not only, of course, to United States, but to Canada, real people who felt strong about their Jewish roots, the Zionism, they went to Israel. Some people, Germany had just to make up for what happened during the war, they offered Soviet Jews to come over to their country to somehow pay back and let those people, because in Germany it was huge. I mean, again, huge, not in terms of numbers, but the most famous philosopher, literature people, scientists, you name it, the thinkers were Jewish. So anyway, some people, even though with knowing what happened during, for me, it's hard to even imagine to immigrate to Germany, but nevertheless, German offered a very big social support to those Jewish families who would be willing to immigrate. We came to America with, yes, as you said, my ex-husband, and at the time, luckily, it was, again, such a never-experienced sense of coming freedom to this country. It was not Soviet Union cold yet. It was not cold yet Russia. It was in between because it was cold. Anyway, it was a feeling that if you, like anybody in this world, you go to, let's say, France to live, right? You live there a few years and you feel, no, it's not my, I really miss my family, my country, my lifestyle, and you able to come back. So my husband and I, we decided, because so many of our friends, our acquaintance and friends were making Aliyah to Israel or coming here, and we decided we should try, because we were relatively young at that time, not completely young, but relatively young, and we had this opportunity at least. And nobody was safe that this opportunity will stay forever. So we thought, okay, we will go, even though we had not even one relative, not even one acquaintance here, which was, again, as I said, absolutely, mostly uncommon. But it was a very small amount of Soviet Jews who were sponsored. You would have to have a sponsor. And the sponsor would be, if you have a cousins here or your brothers or parents, they would sponsor the families. But since we had nobody, the Jewish Federation, apparently the federations around the countries, they would pull the families out of the bucket, and Fish family, that was my last name, my husband's last name was Aronov, was pulled, and we came to St. Louis, Missouri, knowing only about, believe it or not, St. Louis Blues. It was not the Blues, the team Blues, but St. Louis Blues, the music.
Saint oh, Louis like jazz. Blues.
That was only the knowledge we had about St. Louis.
That's crazy. And what year was that?
It was 1991. Again, it was huge, huge time. The time of truly exodus. And what I also want to stress, only here, I was watching these documentaries on the History Channel. And even right now, it gives me goosebumps about this humongous gathering in Washington, D.C., on the Mall, where American Jewish students, and not only students, had this huge gathering and pushing the Reagan administration Again, they were rallies, exactly, rallies for the Jews to lead the Jewish people who are struggling in the Soviet Union and who wanted to make Aliyah, no matter where, or Israel or here, to let them go, let my people go. We never heard about that living in the Soviet Union. When I watched it years after I came here, I was stunned. I was so touched by that. I truly cried when I was watching that, because we had no idea that because of that huge fight here of American jewelry and young people, the Soviet Jews could make this change.
That's really incredible. So, but obviously coming here, there's a language barrier. So did you speak any English before?
I would say that immigration is very hard thing to do. I would never say that we were hungry here one day, because again, thank you to the Jewish Federation who did incredible job. We came over, it was apartment right here in Olivet, ready, not in Olivet, we started here in University City. It was apartment rented for us by the Jewish Federation. It was furnished, of course it was not fancy, everything was decent. I opened the refrigerator, and again, the tears was running on my cheeks, because I had this very interesting smell I never ever in my life smelled while living in the Soviet Union. And it was a smell of celery. By the age of 30, I never tried celery. That makes really, you know, I've heard from your mom that you are a great cook, and it really brings a lot of wonderful taste and smell to anything you cook. So while we came over, neither me nor my husband knew any English. For some crazy reason, in the Soviet Union, beside many subjects, it would be a foreign language. And 2 out of 3 schools, for some reason, taught German. After the war, I don't know why German, but that was my second language. So when I came over here, of course, we tried to take courses in English. But to be honest, 3 words were in my vocabulary, very strong, and I pretty much used them comfortably. Hi, bye, and okay. So there was not spoken English, and that was the hardest. Why? Because not having anybody around, not being able to communicate with people.
That must have been incredibly difficult to come here. And I mean, there was so much to, I'm sure, culture shock coming to from like a socialistic type of government to coming to a government that's democratic and has so much freedom. How was that transition for you in terms of being able to support your family and learn English?
As I say to all my acquaintance or friends in America, we came not from a different country. At that time, we came from a different planet. People who come over from Ukraine right now, a lot of immigrants, and even Russians who don't want to live under this horrible, almost dictatorship of nowadays government in Russia. They are coming from totally different society because they lived at least 20 years in not capitalism, but something in between. They knew what is a free market is. They were able to travel and so forth. We were different people. If you would meet me in 91, it would be totally different, even if I would be able to speak English. So, of course, I started like some people were able to go right away to community college and even with a very rudimental English to take some courses. But I was so restricted because I had 2 small children, nobody to help me. My husband started working, even though he was an engineer back in Russia, he started working like majority of Russian men, driving a taxi cab. And I was my very first dollar that I make, really, you probably will, it's hard to believe even for me right now. Somebody called me and said that in Crown Center here, there is a gentleman who is partially incapable, he was paralyzed, and he needed a person to wash his floor once a week. And here I am with a bucket and a map walking from my apartment. At that time, we lived in Indian Trails in Olivet. So it was a 45 minutes walk to by feet and pregnant. I was walking back and forth to wash his floor for $7. And that was my first money I made. Later through the years, I was trying to count how many jobs, very, very menial jobs I was making. I was babysitting, taking care of elderly people, working in the nursing home, working as a waiter. It was a wonderful restaurant across from the Galleria Andre, European French bakery. Doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. So I was waiting tables. I was working as a salesperson. So little by little, as my English, I was not able to go to the English language school, unfortunately, as the majority of Soviet Jews were, they were free of charge. But again, I was staying home with my kids for a long time until my neighbor, a wonderful woman who is in her 90s right now, and she is still alive, thanks God, was coming and helping us to take care of my children. So I was able to do these jobs. And maybe the difference between what we paid to her and what I was making were $3-4. So years passed, and all these years also, I of course was willing and longing for what I used to do, and I wanted to write some stories, the human interest stories, which I started doing with the help of a wonderful person who also came to my apartment one day. She showed up through the Jewish Federation, and she helped me, this lady Susan, we were talking almost by fingers and little words that I would find. I would write my story in Russian and try to my best to translate it in a very clumsy English. And she would help me to make it readable, not only readable, but really presentable. And I was doing for maybe 7, 8, 10 years. I was freelancing for the Jewish Light of St. Louis, writing human interest stories about Russian Jews who, like myself, came to this country with two suitcases that all you could bring with you. And we didn't have anything pretty much at that time, because we lived in the government apartment, so we didn't have anything to sell before we moved to this country. So as for me, in one of my suitcases was a basic, you know, clothing. And in the second suitcase, I had the photographs and children books that I was bringing. My husband was very mad, by the way. He said, "Wow, you need to take some more useful stuff." And I said, "That my treasure, my photographs of my family, my friends, because who knows if we ever be able to go back. And I need to read my children the night stories before they go to bed." And I brought lots of Russian books, children books that my parents used to read to me before sleeping, going to bed. Wow. Yes, so I had about 15 like menial jobs, and then I had a few courses. Of course, I started taking courses in English and some typing in community college, And I got my first paraprofessional job with a special school district in St. Louis, working 1 year in the school as a teacher assistant. By that time, I always wanted since day number one to explore what is to be Jewish, my Jewish kind world. And this wonderful host family, who also I met through the Jewish Federation, Rick and Marcy Kornfeld, they belong to the United Hebrew Congregation, Reform Congregation. And they introduced me to the director of the school at that time. It was a wonderful lady. She doesn't live in St. Louis anymore. And she hired me. I said, please take me as a teacher assistant. And the teacher assistant at the school is pretty much the girl who it usually the high school kids who take the kids if they need to go to the bathroom or pour the juice for them. So I wanted, through just being in these classes, to catch some knowledge in Judaism. So that's how I started. And then I went through a few other Reform temples. I was working as a in a summer camp at Sheremes. Then I worked for quite many years at Central Reform Congregation, teaching in the second grade. I started feeling that I want more. It is not really my place. And I started asking around the people. Oh, I'm sorry. I again touch again the Jewish topic. But after working 1 year in a special school district, I was able to get, believe it or not, a job at Washington University Library Law School. I'm not a librarian. I don't have a library education, unfortunately. I was hired as a public service assistant. So my job was at the time quite good, quite comfortable. I was able to meet students, meet people there. It's a beautiful campus, of course. It was a nice place to work. And I worked there for 20 years. But all these years, on the weekends, again, I worked in the Sunday schools in several Reform temples. But at a certain point, I realized that I need more and I need something different. And one of my friends, luckily, pointed me towards Rabbi Greenwald, who is a rabbi at Eisha Torah organization here in St. Louis, and I am his disciple since. So that's kind of my story in a very concise.
I wonder if we ever like passed by each other and didn't realize it, because when I was in high school, I actually taught as a Sunday school teacher at Eisha Torah, and Rabbi Greenwald was actually one of my teachers when I was in high school. So yeah. Full circle, everybody's connected.
St. Louis is very, even for myself now, I see how St. Louis is such a small world, especially if you belong to the Jewish circle.
For sure.
People, of course, even myself who came, who didn't have anybody here. Yes, you're right. It's a very interesting.
I mean, your story is so incredibly powerful, and I think one thing that stands out throughout all was that your desire to always chase what was meaningful to you and what intrigued you, despite the fact how scary it might be. And that is so incredibly powerful, because I think so many people want to grow and want to try new things, but that fear holds them back. And so your story isn't an easy one, and it wasn't always happy.
Oh, no.
But it's incredibly meaningful.
Thank you. And believe it or not, 20 years after working in the library, right now I have a part-time job with Torah Prep School, working with children, from a very observant families here, mostly from University City, where we sit now in your house, or Chesterfield, and working with not the supervision, but I work as an assistant to your mom, who is unbelievably excellent. Just, I can't find the word to describe an exceptional teacher and pedagogue. Do you? Is this word exist? Pedagogue, pedagogue. It's more than a teacher. It's not only you get knowledge from this person, but you also get a wisdom and knowledge how to live your life. So he gives you more than just a particular facts. So that's how I found that your mom, Maura Adina, is. And some other teachers, I work in several classes, and I learned from, believe it or not, kindergarten and first grade kids more than I knew living here my first 20 years.
That makes a lot of sense to me, because kindergarten, first grade, that's foundation, right? So that's, you know, usually if you have a good core in elementary school years, that will help you later on in life. And yeah, my mom has been teaching forever. She even taught me when I was in first grade. So that was over 20 years ago. So it just goes to show when you really love something. But it must be so incredible for you to be surrounded by this now. Like, would you ever have imagined back in the day that something like this was possible? That there's like a Jewish Orthodox school and there's little kids living observant lives growing up in a free country?
Yeah, they want to. Sometimes they ask me questions, and one time I am staying, many times, I'm staying behind this tiny, good Jewish kopfs, good tiny kids with incredible intelligence and incredible knowledge in, of course, Hebrew and Jewish studies, and I feel like they are I stay when they read from Siddur or Torah, and I stay behind them trying to catch up. They chant, and I just mesmerize listening to how easy and how natural is that, not having it in my life whatsoever. And a few students asked me, Mrs. Fish, you don't know Hebrew? And I said, unfortunately, I don't. And I have to be very honest with you. You probably won't believe me, but in my childhood, we were not allowed to even believe in God, to even pray, to go to synagogue. There were no synagogues. And even the Russians, who are Russian Orthodox, obviously Christians, they were not able to go to their churches. It was completely atheistic society, and the basis of the communism ideology is atheism. There is no God. There is nothing you believe in other than your morals, your way of life. It's straight Darwin theory about, you know, how human race evolved, and you don't know anything alternative. It was forbidden. You could not keep Bible, Torah in your house. It was unheard of.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So switching the topic just a tiny bit. So we caught up on understanding what brought you here and learning about communist the USSR, the Soviet Union, and then what happened before the Iron Curtain, or yeah, the Iron Curtain came down, and then afterwards. And so now we know that there is the Ukrainian war against Russia. And so I know this is a very sensitive topic, and so we don't have to go too in deep in depth if it's too sensitive for you. But I would love to hear your thoughts on what is going on over there.
It is a very painful and embarrassing topic, even among friends here, among families in Russia. And I told you that my brother, who is a quite big in his area scientist, there are split in the families completely. Like here you can make an analogy like Republicans or Democrats after recently, in recent year, but it's even much worse because it is a war between two absolutely, not absolutely similar. No, I would never say that Ukrainians and Russians are similar, but when I grew up and they were no closer ethnically and in any way, it was the most brotherly relationship, at least, again, what we learn through our literature, through our poetry, through our, especially propaganda again. Russians and Ukrainians were like siblings, not even relatives. It's like a sibling connection, relationship. And even imagine that Russians would so barbarically attack this tiny little country, comparing against, look at the map. One day last year gives me goosebumps, and I was really, at that time, my eyes was filled with tears. The girls in the fourth grade, we were standing, they have a map in their classroom, and they said, Mrs. Fish, why look at the map? Russia is so huge. Why it needs this small country, Ukraine? Why this war? Even those girls who are just, what, in the fourth grade, you're...
They're like 9, 10 years old.
Even these kids... Bringing up this question, it is so unimaginable and absolutely horrific. Again, this awful man, that is not even the right word. In Yiddish, it is Meshugane, but he is not Meshugane. He knows what he's doing. I'm talking about this ugly Putin guy. He told, that was his one of the first statements when he became a president, that he, in his mind, the worst tragedy that happens to the Soviet Union was the breakage of the so that all the 15 republics that were a part of the Soviet Union moved away to become the separate countries. And this aggression, it is a latest in a number of aggression to other small countries like Moldova, like Georgia. I'm not even talking Baltic republics that were always oriented to the West. But what they do in Ukraine, it is horror beyond any imagination. The horror, what they do to the cities, they demolish beautiful, during this 20 years after Ukraine became independent, it had such a huge progress in terms of economic, the way of life people were So many Ukrainians are very hard workers. The men are very handy. They almost every family who wanted to have their own house, they would build a beautiful house. The women would make a beautiful front backyard, grow wonderful flowers, vegetables. It is very rich soil in Ukraine, so you just drop a stick and it becomes a peach tree. So, but now it is a disaster. So many people are killed, the children raped, the women raped, the children are stolen from the families. I can't even... Lately, I stopped watching and listening podcasts because it really makes me so depressed that Russians who were during the Second World War and Ukrainians and any other nations, people are afraid to talk anything other than what the propaganda is. They have, again, completely cut from the Western world. Even if I talk to my friends, which I still have in Russia, the friends who I grew up with, and even my brother, I have to speak. I can't speak openly to him. I have to use, like, not a silent language, I can't, but I can't ask him any direct question. I can't talk to him on any topics related to the war in Ukraine. And the censorship is exactly like it used to be, even at the time when my parents grew up. Again, my time was much more vegetarian. It was not good, but not as awful as during the Stalin and about 20 years after. So this war is a tragedy unimaginable size, and it's a tragedy for Russians as well, because Russians, the soldiers who are going to this war, Russia always had a lack of young men. They are also dying in thousands if they want or not. Some go like a good patriot. They are so fed up by this propaganda that Ukraine is fascist, nationalist country that they do want to go and kill. But so many guys have just no choice. They are drafted and they come back either in the containers being killed. And with the last development in Ukraine, with a dam of the river, the largest river in Ukraine was demolished. It is a humongous ecological non-repairable, it's unrepairable ecological catastrophe beside the catastrophe that happens to the country, which beautiful towns and villages are wiped out from the earth. And of course, the human losses, that's the most horrific one. So I cry my tears for Ukrainians, and I cry my tears for Russians, because they are forever. I doubt that they will be a nation who would be respected or have its position in the world after that barbaric acts. And the war is... Russians believe that they will be able to come to Kyiv and have it in several days. And the war lasts more than a year. And it is very, very, very tragic events we live through.
So in the past, the U.S. has always been like a big brother and has always fought for freedom in other countries. And so people seem to be more divided than ever. People talk about how the United States right now is so broken within our own government. There's so much problems within our own economy. People feel that we should just stay focused on our own land before we start fighting the wars of others. So being part of both worlds, it's not an easy question.
No.
But maybe it's just a good conversation at least to get started. Do you think that this is something that the U.S. should get involved in, or is this not something that we should be involved in at this time?
War after war, let's start with as far as Vietnam War, that Americans try to help their other nations to create certain, bring the democracy and help and establish peace and so forth. And war after war, I know that many of my Russian countrymen might blame me and will be quite angry with me saying that. But unfortunately, with the best intention, as soon as the war is over or American pull their armies out of these countries, the people have no respect. To the contrary, they have a bad feelings about America. They are perceived Americans as pushy, and it's not their business. It's our wars. It's our decisions. So I hear these arguments, and I cannot be living in this country for so many years and knowing what a humongous impact each war that America is involved in brings on American economy and people. How many, how many roads which are now, nowadays, it reminds me of Russian roads, which were always a trouble in Russia. So in this regard, I'm very split. At the same time, if the countries, the West, not only America, but of course the European Union countries, would not help Ukraine, it will be no chance of Ukraine to stop this atrocious war. So I don't know what to say to you. I can't say yes or no. We certainly should give Ukraine as much help as possible, but can we afford this help when we know that the
depth.
Can you please say it in a good English? The how many trillion dollars America has in our budget, and again the American boys who are going to this country and coming back in the coffins. I'm very, very. It is a question which I struggle with. I struggle with myself. As much as I want Ukrainians, especially, they need not as much money as airplanes. If they would have supplied by the airplanes, the war would be over a long time ago. But the nations don't want to, have a fight with Putin and his clique, and that's very scary, because Putin would not stop in Ukraine. He would go farther, and like we knew from the day number one, that it is a beginning of the Third World War. I'm sorry for such a pessimistic opinion on my part, but that's how I see this horrifying happenings, this war between, it's not the war between Russia and Ukraine, it's a war between empire, which is Russia, and the rest of the civilization.
Appreciate you so much. sharing your story. Your life has been incredible. You've done so much with it. I love your thirst for knowledge. You're an incredibly intelligent woman. And thank you so much for taking the time today to sit with me and to share your story.
Wishing you the best too.
Thanks.
And to your mom, of course.
Yeah.
And your dad.
I hope you guys have a great week. Let's get it. Let's go.